which was based in St. Louis and dominated a wide swatch of territory from Arkansas to Texas. It was decided that Chess Carley would monopolize the oil trade east of the Mississippi, while Waters Pierce would control the area southwest of the river. The Waters Pierce deal brought another patent scoundrel into the trust, Henry Clay Pierce, who made F.D. Carley look like a cherub in comparison. By age 19, this country doctor's son monopolized the kerosene trade in St. Louis, and then he mounted a pony and branched out into Arkansas and Texas. Even Standard Oil people never defended Henry Clay Pierce. One executive recalled him as a gifted businessman, but added, "He couldn't do a thing straight if it could be done crooked. He was cordial and polite enough, and it was only when he got into a jam with people that he became nasty. Then they knew they were fighting someone. He was the greatest fighter you ever saw." Once again, Rockefeller self-servingly disclaimed knowledge of the roughhouse tactics used by the Waters Pierce salesman and portrayed Pierce as a loose cannon who operated on his own initiative. He said that he never gave a minute in a month to this local trade and that any marketing excesses, when exposed, were condemned by the executive committee. But his files show that he received a full accounting of Pierce's high crimes and misdemeanors. When Pierce made a highly profitable foray into the Mexican market in 1880, Colonel Thompson reported to Rockefeller that this had been accomplished largely by evasion of the enormous duty placed upon refined oil by Mexico. Enriched by this operation, Pierce declared a 100% dividend on capital the next year. Thompson repeatedly warned Rockefeller about Pierce, branding him a man not without designs, and relaying a letter showing great duplicity on the part of Mr. Pierce. Far from rebuking Pierce, in 1892, Rockefeller extended him a personal loan for $200,000, a king's ransom, and patiently carried him for 8 years. Clearly, he had no qualms about the buccaneering spirit of the Waters Pierce business. The Standard Oil marketing subsidiaries fanned out across the remaining sections of the continent. In 1878, the Consolidated Tank Line Company took over the territory north of the Missouri River, spread across Michigan and Minnesota, then expanded westward into the Dakotas. Formed in 1884, the Continental Oil Company covered the Rocky Mountain states. In the mid-1870s, the trust sent a young executive to California, Wesley H. Tilford, who foresaw the state's potential as both an oil producer and consumer. A decade later, Standard Oil of Iowa developed this West Coast trade. Many frustrated customers of Waters Pierce turned in revenge to Republic Oil, a New York-based company that specialized in cultivating retailers who loathed the trust. Of course, Republic was secretly owned by Standard Oil. Around 1886, 26 Broadway divided the continent into 11 marketing districts, with boundary disputes to be resolved by a domestic trade committee. As subsidiaries raided each other's territories, their clashes were arbitrated by headquarters. Nothing so clearly reveals the trust's imperial character than its deliberations about marketing territories, where exclusive rights to entire states and countries were dispensed like so many royal charters. At one point, when Chess Carley, Waters Pierce, and Consolidated Tank Line tangled over the virgin southwestern territory, Colonel Thompson explained to Rockefeller, "I have for a long time waited for the opportunity of defining the western limits of all these connections, and take the liberty of saying on behalf of Standard Oil Company that we had never conceded to anyone the right to go and occupy Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, or Mexico." In the end, Standard Oil ceded Mexico to Henry Pierce in a swap for the state of New Mexico. Once Rockefeller controlled a marketing territory, he protected it fiercely and quickly dispatched troops to fend off the smallest incursion. If Standard Oil spotted even one carload of outside oil entering its territory, it traced its source through railroad agents and moved swiftly to halt it. Standard Oil marketing men were known to trail competitors' wagons and undersell them if necessary. This unceasing drive, this implacable need to win, emanated from Rockefeller himself. When told that competitors had appeared in St. Louis, he exhorted Oliver Payne, "Regret to hear that those parties have established an agency in St. Louis. We must not let them get the business. Why not make a good, hard, vigorous fight with the view of taking it all back again, and not let them retain a foothold there, and the same in St. Paul?" As the capstone of this system, Rockefeller fostered an extensive intelligence network, assembling thick card catalogs with monthly reports from field agents, showing every barrel of oil sold by independent marketers in their territory. From 26 Broadway, the Titan could peer into the most distant corners of his realm. Standard Oil spies collected much of this information from grocers and railway freight agents. One Cleveland refiner discovered that Standard paid his bookkeeper $25 a month to provide information on his shipments, mailing these trade secrets to Box 164 at the Cleveland Post Office. Standard's reputation as a pervasive, all-seeing presence was richly deserved. The manic vigor of Standard's salesman becomes understandable in light of a secret policy that Archbold enunciated to Rockefeller in an 1891 letter. Station managers were expected to command at least 85%, and if possible much more, of the oil trade in their district, a punishing standard that goaded them into aggressive tactics. Because they had carte blanche to reduce prices and use any other means necessary to hold the trade, they created pitched battles in many cities. One repentant Standard Oil marketer named Charles Woodbury recalled a favorite scare tactic. Substantial rumors that the few independents surviving might not much longer be able to supply oil at all continually alarmed their customers. Rockefeller found nothing reprehensible about this intelligence network and could never understand the eternal fuss. The practice of the Standard Oil Company in this regard brings no credit or discredit to the Standard Oil Company, he later told William O. Inglis. It was following out a method in universal use by the largest and most intelligent distributors of goods the country over. Some Standard Oil people, however, refused to stoop to these methods. When Charles Woodbury protested eavesdropping on competitors, his superior gruffly insisted, "We do not intend merely to grasp the situation. We must control it." Woodbury replied, "But this is espionage. I cannot stand over these men and make them go after these details." After being censured for such squeamishness, he quit in protest. Recounting this in 1911, Woodbury left some tart comments about Rockefeller's assumed innocence. "Results were what the master asked for," he explained. "Details, Rockefeller need not know. He could be left to his own self-effacement. He had selected his staff." In short, Rockefeller posted the sales targets, whipped up the fervor, then forswore any knowledge of the inevitable consequences. To square his actions with his conscience, always a necessity for Rockefeller, he needed to invoke an overarching theme, vouchsafing cheap light to humanity. Touring a well drilled on Oil Creek in the early days, he stared at it silently and then intoned, "This is the poor man's light." Such remarks weren't just for public consumption, but were commonplaces in his correspondence. In 1885, he instructed a young colleague, Henry C. Folger, "Let the good work go on. We must ever remember we are refining oil for the poor man, and he must have it cheap and good." Having grown up in secluded farmhouses, reading by candlelight, he understood the revolutionary impact of cheap kerosene. Rockefeller never had a single motive for any action and was surely motivated by more than altruism in championing cheap kerosene. He was obsessed with high-volume, low-cost production to maintain market share, even if he temporarily sacrificed profit margins. As he noted, "This fact the Standard Oil Company always kept in mind, that they must render the best service and be content with a largely increasing volume of business, rather than increase the profit so as to tempt others to compete with them." When discussing prices with subordinates, he frequently reminded them, We want to continue in reason that policy which will give us the largest percentage of the business. The public tolerated the trust's brawny tactics for a long time because it believed that it had, over the long run, cheapened kerosene and exercised a relatively benevolent dictatorship. As journalist Henry Demarest Lloyd wrote scornfully to George Rice in 1891, "Thus the public, dear fools, believe, and it entirely reconciles them, knavish fools, to the piracies, treasons, and murders by which the fabled cheapness has been brought to them." Befuddled reformers assailed the trust for selling both too high and too low, for fleecing consumers and underselling rivals. As John Archbold summed up the paradox, "It is usually alleged that whenever the standard, for whatever reason, advances its prices, it is oppressing the consumer, and when, if, on the other hand, it lowers its prices, it is then oppressing its competitors." Of course, both things were often true, since Standard Oil kept prices high where it faced no competition, and low where it had to keep rivals at bay. On balance, the trust wielded its monopolistic power to keep prices artificially low to forestall competition. In general, Standard Oil did an excellent job at providing kerosene at affordable prices. It boasted far lower unit costs than competitors and relentlessly drove down costs over the years. Between 1880 and 1885, its average cost of processing a gallon of crude oil went from 2.5 to 1.5 cents. In a rare 1890 newspaper interview, a supremely confident Rockefeller said that since Standard's birth 20 years before, the retail price of kerosene had plunged from 23.5 to 7.5 cents per gallon. Only half that drop, he contended, had resulted from the steep fall in crude oil prices, and he credited the tank wagon system for much of the savings. In the early 1900s, the Bureau of Corporations attributed most of the drop in kerosene prices to a sharp dip in crude oil prices, not to Standard's super-efficient management. Whatever the truth, the resulting low prices inoculated the public for a long time against the anti-Standard venom. Many of Rockefeller's foes contended that routine underselling was his most lethal weapon, even more destructive than railroad rebates. As the industry's low-cost producer, Standard merely had to dump oil at cost to stamp out competitors. The practice of selling at or below cost, which started in the 1870s, intensified with the tank wagon system, which permitted the trust to set retail prices. Hesitant to initiate price wars, which smacked of the old Darwinian competition, Rockefeller said that he cut prices only defensively, that is, when forced to retaliate against price-cutting independents. When he did so, he showed no mercy against these reprobates and said with righteous indignation, "These people did not want cooperation, they wanted competition, and when they got it, they didn't like it." Alan Nevins cited a federal study of predatory pricing that found that Standard Oil practiced it in only 37 of 37,000 towns serviced by its tank wagons, and then only in response to cuts by competitors. Yet Rockefeller's files are so rife with references to this practice as to refute Nevins's verdict. In an 1886 letter, Colonel Thompson told Rockefeller that Standard sold at cost wherever competition appeared and compensated for the lost profits by raising prices in less competitive locales. "We find the outsiders, mainly from Pittsburgh and the oil region, had 2,000 barrels of oil in Cincinnati. We have lowered the Cincinnati market an additional half cent temporarily to meet that competition and forced them to sell their oil without a profit." In contrast, he noted that with independents now banished from Chicago, "We jacked that price up a quarter or so without multiplying instances. We are doing all around. The system is working well, better than any other we can devise, and our feeling is to hold along on this basis. I beg you and the other gentlemen will keep in mind the fact that we are selling one quarter of all the oil we handle without a farthing of profit to this department." If Standard Oil sold one quarter of all its oil at cost, as Thompson alleged, that would have meant anti-competitive price cuts in more than 9,000 towns, quite different from the 37 cited by Nevins. The trust used such infinite sleight of hand in setting prices, obscuring the real price through secret discounts, that a definitive accounting is impossible. Though many states had already outlawed predatory pricing, they found such a ban difficult to enforce. On this issue, Rockefeller remained an unreconstructed monopolist, defending Standard Oil's price cutting years later by commenting, "If in doing so they were losing money, which they made up on some of the specialties, they made up the difference, would it be a crime?" Eventually, a national ban on such predatory pricing formed an integral component of antitrust legislation. Standard's policy of differential pricing also proved expedient in the global marketplace. During the 1880s and 1890s, trying to stem the tide of Russian and East Indian oil, the organization charged lower prices in Europe and compensated with higher American prices. Its tight control of the home market enabled it to prosecute savage price wars against the Nobels, Rothschilds, Royal Dutch, and Shell. For this reason, Standard Oil always considered its domestic monopoly a necessary precondition for its overseas conquests. But Standard Oil never sought a perfect monopoly because Rockefeller realized that it was politically prudent to allow some feeble competition. As he admitted, "We realized that public sentiment would be against us if we actually refined all the oil." The Combine ceded about 10% of the refining and marketing business to a tiny group of fringe rivals. Even in the mid-1880s, 93 mostly marginal refineries were allowed to operate. A very smart monopolist, Rockefeller kept prices low enough to retain control of the market, but not so low as to wipe out all lingering competitors. We must retire one common canard about Rockefeller. He didn't set crude oil prices through blanket edicts. In his correspondence, one sees the oil king trying to guess the trend of crude prices and bemoaning speculation. As he told one of his personal financial advisors in 1882, "Crude oil is about the worst commodity in the world to speculate in. It is about as uncertain as railroad stocks." Perhaps the chief way that Standard Oil influenced crude prices was by elevating or dropping storage charges at its pipelines, which the firm sometimes used to break speculative raids. By issuing certificates against oil stored by its pipelines, it stimulated a free market in crude oil, and hundreds of thousands of people speculated in or borrowed against these certificates, creating the first oil futures market and setting the trend for spot prices. After the National Petroleum Exchange opened in Manhattan in late 1882, the speculators far outweighed the trust in importance in pegging prices. As Rockefeller boasted, Standard Oil was an infallible moneymaker. In the late 1880s, Henry M. Flagler testified it had average earnings of 13% a year on net assets, which considerably understated its performance. When Teddy Roosevelt's Bureau of Corporations later examined the matter, it computed a more handsome 19% return from 1882 to 1896. Rockefeller defended these high returns as justified by the fear that the oil might run dry and render the trust's vast investment worthless. He knew public opinion was inflamed by the exorbitant dividends declared on Standard Oil shares, which sometimes ran as high as 200%. These figures were misleading, Rockefeller argued, since Standard Oil's actual capital was typically 10 times its official capitalization. In terms of real capital, the 200% dividend declared in January 1885 was more like 20%. Extremely high, but not astronomical. Such a rich but not altogether outrageous return was just what the politic Rockefeller wanted. Rockefeller knew that if he got greedy, other products could be substituted for kerosene, and this too curbed his appetite for excess profits. Oil was just one of many fossil fuels, and kerosene one of many potential illuminants. In the fall of 1878, America's Wunderkind, Thomas Alva Edison, boasted to reporters at Menlo Park, New Jersey, that he had dreamed up a practical electric light bulb. Within a year, he had created a miraculous bulb that glowed brightly for 100 straight hours and directly threatened Rockefeller's kerosene business. The new Edison Electric Light Company enlisted affluent bankers, including the august Drexel Morgan and Company. On September 4, 1882, Edison stood in J.P. Morgan's offices at 23 Wall Street and threw a switch that brightened Morgan's office with electric lighting, inaugurating a generating plant in Lower Manhattan. Luckily for Rockefeller, the light bulb didn't instantly drive out kerosene. It took time for Edison to cover the country with power stations, and by 1885, only 250,000 light bulbs shone across America. Instead of electric light, the soft, shimmering glow of gas light began illuminating many American cities in the 1880s. For a long time, natural gas had been discarded by oilmen as a waste product, until a business group led by J.N. Pugh piped natural gas to Pittsburgh in 1883. Quick to perceive that natural gas complemented the oil business, Rockefeller advised Daniel O'Day that Standard Oil should develop its own strength in this area rather than turning to outsiders. O'Day and his ebullient team assured Rockefeller that they could pipe explosive gas long distances without mishaps. Within 2 years, they were piping gas from western Pennsylvania to cities in Ohio and New York. And by the late 1890s, Rockefeller secretly oversaw natural gas companies in Titusville, Oil City, Buffalo, and 13 other localities. As one newspaper said, consumers in some of these places would be surprised to learn that they are burning Standard Oil gas. To counter competition from gaslight, Edison based his promotional scheme upon a moral and aesthetic contrast between good electric light and evil gaslight. Of the flickering gaslight that later generations found so enchantingly poetic, he sneered, "It is a nasty yellow light, too, and far removed from the color of the lovely natural light," while he touted the soft radiance of electric lights as singularly powerful and even perfectly steady. With a persistence worthy of Standard Oil's crusaders, Edison sales agents approached customers using outmoded gas jets and urged them to switch to advanced electric lamps. The promotion of natural gas involved Rockefeller in sanguinary battles, for the major customers were municipalities, and the decisions were always highly political. The natural gas business fed rampant corruption, a veritable cornucopia of graft, as companies manipulated urban officials to get these franchises. Though Rockefeller regularly denied knowledge of such machinations, his papers tell a different story. He exercised a supervisory role and knew all about the money funneled to politicians. In securing the Detroit franchise, Standard Oil furnished an emissary, G.A. Shelby, with $15,000 in cash and $10,000 in gas stock to sway politicians. When payment came tardily, Shelby groused to Rockefeller, "Will you guarantee the amount stated if ordinance passes and is approved by the mayor? I have been to considerable expense and want to be sure of prompt settlement when work is completed." In the natural gas battles, the porous boundaries between politics and business began to crumble and disappear. In 1886, Daniel O'Day met behind closed doors in Philadelphia with the rival Columbia Natural Gas Company, and fairly gasped at the political luminaries who were represented. As he told Rockefeller, "I was astonished to learn the people who are in it. All of the Republican local politicians of Philadelphia are stockholders. They are very much afraid of their investment and feel now that unless they make some alliance with us, that they will in all probability lose all their money, or a great share of it." From pure expediency, O'Day favored a deal with their rivals, telling Rockefeller, "The feeling generally was to push the company to the wall, a feeling in which I would fully share, were it not for the fact that the stockholders of the company might be very bad enemies to have in the Pennsylvania legislature next winter." Unconvinced by such pragmatic reasoning, the executive committee overruled O'Day. The most bitter natural gas fracas erupted in Toledo, Ohio, where the former governor, Charles Foster, was an old boyhood friend of Flagler and a recipient of Standard Oil campaign largesse. In July 1886, O'Day reported to Flagler that the ex-governor had agreed to merge his Fostoria Illuminating Gas Company with the Standard's Toledo gas startup to form the Northwestern Ohio Natural Gas Company. O'Day relayed the secret terms of this arrangement: that Governor Foster be president of the company, but that we would have full control of management. Toledo citizens were delighted when the Eastern Ohio Natural Gas Company decided to vie with Northwestern for a gas franchise. In a compromise settlement, both companies received franchises. Then it surfaced that both rival companies were controlled by Standard Oil, and in the ensuing brouhaha, city officials decided in retaliation to erect their own municipal gas works. Politicians in the Gilded Age tended to dispense with euphemisms, preferring cash on the barrelhead. Having done Standard Oil's bidding in the gas business, Foster demanded his payoff from Rockefeller in January 1888, saying his campaign committee had a debt of almost $1,200. "My suggestion to you," he told Rockefeller bluntly, "is that you send me a check for this amount. I have refused to ask you or your people for contributions for several years past. In this case, I did it because I know that you feel an interest with us, and for the further reason that I thought it would be helpful in warding off the blows made at you and at our gas company." In reply, Rockefeller sent Foster $1,000, though he couldn't resist appending some barbed comments on his past performance. "Our friends do feel that we have not received fair treatment from the Republican Party, but we expect better things in the future." In 1886, Standard Oil set up the Natural Gas Trust, with Rockefeller as its largest shareholder. As such, he presided over these sordid municipal skirmishes, albeit keeping a sanitary distance. He followed matters closely, but never soiled his hands, so that he could profess ignorance of the whole matter. If Rockefeller tried to deny responsibility for his more deplorable actions, he had legions of critics who loudly proclaimed that he had maliciously ruined them. As Ida Tarbell noted, his foes endowed him with superhuman powers. Strange as the statement may appear, there is no disputing that by 1884 the oil regions as a whole looked on Mr. Rockefeller with superstitious awe. Each day's mailbag brought more invective from total strangers who cursed him and pleaded for relief. The most bile flowed from western Pennsylvania oilmen who believed that he capriciously decreed crude oil prices each morning. As one Bradford producer told him, "The situation here is truly alarming, and hundreds of families are in actual distress that need not be if the price of oil was what thousands believe you could make it." Another correspondent warned him, "There are thousands here on the verge of financial ruin on account of the low price obtained for their product. And if it is within your power to give them a better price, you would bestow a boon inestimable in its value to this entire country." Sometimes these malcontents seemed torn over whether Rockefeller was Satan or Santa Claus, as shown by this muddled query from P.O. Lochner: "I am a poor devil of a piker in the oil market and have been in the business for 8 years. During all this time I've been cursing the Standard Oil Company with the rest of the boys, curses loud and deep. But with all the anathemas hurled at it, the SOC is still in existence and continues to pile up enormous wealth. Now, as the market is completely dead and my occupation gone, I have come to the conclusion that it would be wisdom to stop cursing the Standard and strike it for a good fat position." After his scandal-ridden childhood with Big Bill, Rockefeller had a fine instinct for enemies and was sensitive to this crescendo of criticism. When out for a walk, he was vigilant and preternaturally aware of anyone following him. It was impossible to sneak up behind him. Yet he lent no credence to his critics and regarded their putative idealism as a flimsy cover for selfish motives. Rockefeller saw himself stoically suffering the fate of all revolutionary figures. "The ideas on which we worked were new," he explained. "But knowing that we were right, we went steadily about our business, founded on ideas that were an irresistible force. He identified many critics as competing refiners who had foolishly taken cash instead of Standard Oil stock for their plants. His melodramatic rendition of it was this. "We think about Hades. What more can punish a man than to sit and groan as he contemplates what might have been?" Despite being the target of so much public obloquy, Rockefeller seemed fearless. "The word fear is not found in my father's vocabulary," his son once said. "Nor does he know what the sensation is." Junior recalled being driven to a train station in Manhattan by his father at a time when he was swamped by anarchistic threats. Though Junior begged him to hire bodyguards, his father scoffed. "Why, John," he said, "I can protect myself. If any man should be foolish enough to attack me, well." He did not boast. I've never heard him boast, but he stood up full height with his fists clenched. What he said was to the effect that if anyone should attack him, he was feeling sturdy, and he hoped he wouldn't hurt the poor fellow too much. Junior remembered the evening in Cleveland years earlier when a maid shrieked that a burglar was upstairs. Rockefeller unhesitatingly seized a pistol and strode to the back door, hoping to nab the burglar, who had already slipped down a post and escaped. Rockefeller professed that he bore no malice toward critics and approached them in a spirit of Christian tolerance, so long as they conceded their error. To those who repented their attacks and abuse, we freely extended forgiveness, as we ourselves might hope for mercy and forgiveness from a higher source, he said. As his private life and philanthropy attest, he was not a cruel man and did not have sadistic impulses. Yet he countered critics with ad hominem attacks and frequently referred to their actions as schemes, implying something devious and illegitimate. Whenever he was about to commit some particularly heinous act, he first found a character flaw in the victim, then proceeded with a serene conscience. Proof against criticism, Rockefeller nonetheless provoked a small army of gadflies. Perhaps the most picturesque was Lewis Emery, Jr., the rich Bradford producer and pipeline owner, and a Pennsylvania legislator who served as a major source for Ida Tarbell. If only Rockefeller had played fair, Emery insisted, he would have ended up the more powerful oilman. "I had and have as much brains as John D. Rockefeller, but I have never had his cunning, nor his ability to use unscrupulous means or unscrupulous men to carry out a program," he maintained. Though he spent much of his life stalking the Titan, he never actually met Rockefeller, who was, he explained, too much in the background, too cunning. Standard Oil applied merciless measures to stop Emery's pipelines from linking up with railroads, as shown with his Equitable Pipeline to Buffalo. In 1892, Emery was about to complete a major pipeline to Hancock, New York, where he expected the Ontario and Western Railroad to pick up his oil and transport it to New York City. When Archbold got wind of this, he demanded a showdown with the railroad. His report to Rockefeller shows the lengths that Standard Oil would go to cripple a competitor. "We have had further interviews with the Ontario and Western people and feel that we have made some progress toward a possible understanding with them. It is now entirely sure that there has been no definite engagement entered into by them with the Emery Party, and we think they are now convinced that the rates they had been talking about with the Emery Party are absurdly low, and that business on any such basis would be undesirable and unprofitable. We have made them a proposition of business covering a period of 5 years, and expect an answer from them this week. Our proposition is that we put over their lines 400,000 barrels of oil yearly, or, in default of any part of the amount, pay a penalty of 10% of the existing rates. We think it a very liberal proposition to them." Standard Oil was not content to advance its own interest. It worked actively to damage the business interests of its adversaries. Rockefeller's papers also reveal that Emery was prepared, at one point, to sell his oil properties to Standard Oil, asking for $750,000 in shares of the trust, hypocrisy that only validated Rockefeller's dim opinion of his critics. Another embittered foe was George Rice, a Vermont native and independent refiner from Marietta, Ohio. a vigorous man with a bulldog face, Rice thrived on crossing swords with the oil trust. More than anyone else, Rice was driven mad by Standard Oil's unjust methods and became a professional Rockefeller hater. He instigated many legislative probes of Standard Oil, and in 1881 published a pamphlet entitled Black Death, an anthology of scathing newspaper exposés. For Rockefeller, Rice was nothing but a blackmailer. He liked to harass, embarrass, annoy the Standard Oil interests with a view of enabling him to sell his quite unimportant refinery interest. This is the whole story of George Rice. In fairness to Rockefeller, Rice tried repeatedly to extort money from him, asking an outrageous $250,000 for a refinery Rockefeller valued at only $25,000. To banish this pest, Rockefeller and his colleagues alternated between trying to buy him out and trying to bludgeon him to death. As Colonel Thompson reported to Rockefeller, "Rice admitted that it could be better to occupy friendly relations with us and assumed to be willing to make some arrangement, but extortion was written in every lineament of his countenance and burdened every syllable that fell from his lips." At the time, Rice was lobbying for a federal investigation of Standard Oil's railroad rebates. Though Rice insisted that Standard Oil laid deep plots against him, Rockefeller mocked his criticism as the ravings of an overactive mind. "We might as well assume that the Standard Oil Company would get a 21-inch cannon to shoot mosquitoes." Yet his files show that such a cannonade was fired at Rice. In 1885, Daniel O'Day struck a deal with the Cleveland and Marietta Railroad, which was the lifeline of Rice's refinery. The railroad agreed to charge Standard Oil 10 cents a barrel versus 35 cents for Rice and his fellow independents. Resurrecting the infamous drawback, Standard would also be paid 25 cents for every barrel that Rice shipped. In dictating this deal, O'Day bluntly warned the railroad that if it didn't comply, he would build a competing pipeline and drive them out of business. In a rare successful suit against the trust, Rice forced Standard Oil to repudiate the nefarious contract and refund him $250. With his own brand of courage, Rice tried to market oil against the two roughest Standard Oil subsidiaries, Chess Carley and Waters Pierce. As soon as Rockefeller got reports of even minuscule shipments made by Rice, Standard Oil agents in the affected states were told to thwart him by any means necessary. In 1885, W. H. Tilford told Rockefeller, "As far as Chess Carley Company's territory is concerned, every effort is being made to dislodge Rice. Traveling men are being put upon the road, who go from station to station selling oil in competition with any oil which Rice may have in the various towns." Every time Rice was ejected from another hamlet, Rockefeller was informed, "We have recently driven Rice entirely out of Anniston, Alabama, and feel that we shall soon have him also out of Birmingham," the Chess Carley treasurer reported to Tilford. "Wherever this result is accomplished, however, it has only been by our making very low prices, frequently at a loss to this company, and such loss continued through a long period." No threat to his empire was too small for Rockefeller to overlook. If Emory, Rice, and other anti-Rockefeller mavericks made little headway in the oil industry itself, they were destined to have a powerful impact in the court of public opinion as they coalesced into an influential lobbying group. They formed a ready source of information for journalists, of whom their first polemical champion was a rich, elegant newspaper man named Henry Demarest Lloyd. The son of a Dutch Reformed minister, Lloyd attended Columbia College, passed the New York bar, then married into the wealthy Bross family, co-owners of the Chicago Tribune. Starting in 1878, Lloyd wrote withering editorials about Standard Oil in a florid style that captured the public's imagination. He profited from the flood of revelations produced by the Hepburn hearings in New York and the Pennsylvania lawsuits against Rockefeller. In the March 1881 issue of the Atlantic Monthly, editor William Dean Howells published Lloyd's mordant account of Standard Oil entitled "Story of a Great Monopoly." The first serious exposé of the trust in a prestigious mass circulation magazine, Lloyd's seminal article was a sensation, and the issue went through six printings. For Lloyd, the essence of Standard Oil power resided in its secret alliances with the railroads, which had fostered the growth of many trusts. While conceding the legitimate greatness of Standard Oil, he said that it only made its ethical shortcuts the more reprehensible. Their great business capacity would have ensured the managers of the Standard success, but the means by which they achieved monopoly were by conspiracy with the railroads. A vociferous critic of William H. Vanderbilt, Jay Gould, Tom Scott, and Collis Huntington, Lloyd incorporated his critique of Standard Oil into a comprehensive crusade for railroad reform. He also fastened public attention on John D. Rockefeller as the trust's embodiment, speculating that only William H. Vanderbilt had earned more money the previous year. Lloyd was a slipshod reporter, and his account is marred by many inaccuracies. At one point, he says that Rockefeller had owned a Cleveland flower store. Yet he wrote lapidary prose and showed a keen political and cultural understanding. In a cunning stroke, he converted the piece into a consumer story, stating at the outset, "Very few of the 40 millions of people who burn kerosene know that its production, manufacture, and export, its price at home and abroad, have been controlled for years by a single corporation, the Standard Oil Company." For Lloyd, the octopus, he helped to popularize the nickname, did more than threaten free competition and fair play. It jeopardized American democracy itself. He charged that Standard Oil controlled two U.S. senators and had engaged in so much corruption in Harrisburg that it had done everything with the Pennsylvania legislature except to refine it. A superb phrasemaker, Lloyd declared in a rousing finale that America has the proud satisfaction of having furnished the world with the greatest, wisest, and meanest monopoly known to history. The article introduced Rockefeller to a national audience and fixed antitrust legislation high on the reform agenda. In proposing a federal agency to ensure uniform railroad rates, Lloyd anticipated the Interstate Commerce Act by 6 years. If his attack was a harbinger of things to come, so was Rockefeller's total silence. Confident that posterity would vindicate him, the latter would later explain, "I was concentrated upon extending and developing and perfecting our business, rather than on stopping by the wayside to squabble with slanderers." In common with many contemporary moguls, including J.P. Morgan, Andrew Mellon, James Stillman, Henry Clay Frick, and George F. Baker, Rockefeller resented the press, and his ferocious allegiance to his concern transcended other claims on his conscience. One of his favorite refrains was, "The Standard Oil Company's business was that of saying nothing and sawing wood." During the antitrust furor of 1888, he told one minister, "We have gone upon the principle it were better to attend to our business and pay no attention to the newspapers, with the idea that if we were right, they could not permanently injure us, and if we were wrong, all their comments, though favorable, would not make it right." Rockefeller asserted that he was less afraid of exposing misbehavior by talking to the press than of inadvertently spilling trade secrets. "What could we say," he asked rhetorically, "without telling the world just how we were making our success?" Those few intrepid reporters who tried to penetrate Standard Oil often gave up in despair. When the New York Sun dispatched a reporter to Cleveland in 1882 to investigate Rockefeller, he could not get near the mogul and was stunned by the layers of secrecy that surrounded him. He was further impressed by the silence of hundreds of Standard Oil employees he buttonholed, all schooled in Rockefeller's philosophy. Even with friendly journalists, Rockefeller would not supply a photo of himself in an oil field or refinery, and banned photographers from his home for even the most innocuous magazine spreads. Of course, this invisibility only piqued the public's interest. That silence came so easily to Rockefeller should not surprise us. As an inner-directed man, he required no approbation from others and was much too circumspect to toss out opinions in a newspaper interview. By the mid-1880s, facing severe political assaults, Standard Oil could no longer decline all press contact. In 1885, the Oil City Derrick, long a heated critic of the trust, was bought by an intimate of Captain Vandergrift, who installed Patrick Boyle, a Standard Oil adherent, as its editor. Around 1887, Standard Oil hired a press bureau called the Jennings Publishing Company to place favorable ads, disguised as independent articles, in Ohio newspapers. Soon the Standard cooperated selectively with other periodicals. When Harper's Weekly profiled Rockefeller in 1889, the article was first thoroughly vetted by Archbold. On those odd occasions where Rockefeller sat for interviews, he came across as unfailingly dignified and courteous. In 1890, a reporter for The World described him as a man with an intelligent and pleasant countenance, fair complexion, sandy hair and mustache intermixed with gray, a somewhat prominent nose, mild gray eyes, and an agreeably expressive mouth. The next year, another reporter, braced for a bloody ogre, said of Rockefeller, "He is modest, retiring, gentle-mannered, and without the human vanities which we associate with great millionaires." This favorable coverage should have alerted Rockefeller to two critical facts: that even hostile reporters could be swayed, and that he had a flair for public relations no less pronounced than his gift for making money. Some of the most pungent criticism came from within Standard Oil's own ranks, from isolated subordinates who thought that the trust's muscular tactics offended Christian principle. In the 1870s, Rockefeller recruited a stout, bewhiskered young man, William J. Cook, a grandnephew of J. Cook, whom he had befriended at the Cleveland YMCA. A former wholesale milliner, Cook prospered at Standard and was soon elevated to a manager's post in Toledo. After 3 years, he suddenly quit, unable to reconcile the trust's sales tactics with his Christian faith. As a history of Standard of Ohio notes tactfully, "He didn't see eye to eye with Mr. Rockefeller in the manner of eliminating competitors." Unfortunately, we don't know how Rockefeller reacted to this defection by a devout protege. Perhaps the most extraordinary act of contrition in Standard history came in an eloquent appeal to Rockefeller written by William G. Warden on May 24, 1887. One of the Trust's most senior figures, Warden sent Rockefeller a haunting letter regretting the revulsion that the firm inspired in the popular imagination. "We have met with a success unparalleled in commercial history. Our name is known all over the world, and our public character is not one to be envied. We are quoted as the representative of all that is evil, hard-hearted, oppressive, cruel, we think unjustly. But men look askance at us, we are pointed at with contempt. And while some good men flatter us, it's only for our money, and we scorn them for it, and it leads to a further hardness of heart. This is not pleasant to write, for I had longed for an honored position in commercial life. None of us would choose such a reputation. We all desire a place in the goodwill, honor, and affection of honorable men." After advancing a profit-sharing plan that might assuage the hostility of the oil producers, Warden urged Rockefeller to ponder his letter. "Don't put this down or throw it to one side. Think over it. Talk with Mrs. Rockefeller about it. She is the salt of the earth. How happy she would be to see a change in public opinion and see her husband honored and blessed. May he, whose wisdom alone can put it in our hearts to love our fellow men, guide and direct you at this time. The whole world will rejoice to see such an effort made for the people, the working people." The Warden letter is an exceptional statement, as dramatic in its way as a deathbed confession. It also confirms that Setty Rockefeller was extremely upset by the opprobrium heaped upon her husband. And how did Rockefeller respond to this brave, thoughtful letter? About to sail to Europe with his family, he employed his departure as an excuse to send a short, platitudinous reply. "I have not been able to write you sooner," he wrote the following week, "nor to give a careful consideration, but be assured its content will not escape me." To cool off a tense situation with a bland note was vintage Rockefeller, and there is no evidence that he ever again communicated with Warden on the subject. Chapter 15. Widow's Funeral. As John D. Rockefeller was busy consolidating America's largest industrial empire, his father, William Avery Rockefeller, a.k.a. Dr. William Livingston, was showing his old wanderlust, peddling panaceas under his assumed name. A frontiersman in a nation where the frontier was vanishing, he gravitated to wilderness areas that provided asylum from the modern industrial world epitomized by his son. Huge patches of Bill's life remained a mystery to earlier Rockefeller biographers, but a rough portrait of his later years can now be sketched from Rockefeller's papers and some previously overlooked newspaper and magazine accounts. Bill had relatively little contact with his rich sons, John and William, but was extremely close to the envious Frank, who shared his love of fishing and hunting. Perhaps associating these sports with his prodigal father, John never hunted or fished in later years. After Frank bought an immense ranch in Kansas in the 1880s, his father was a frequent guest, and they hunted quail and prairie chickens together. Much of what we know about Bill's later years derives from his remarkable friendship with a surrogate son, Dr. Charles H. Johnston. When Charles was a baby in 1853, Dr. Livingston visited his Ontario home and cured his mother of an illness. In 1874, Charles, now a young man, encountered Bill in Wisconsin, where Bill cured him of a fever and promised to tutor him in the art of healing. In Freeport, Illinois, Johnston met Mrs. Margaret Allen Livingston and later called her one of the sweetest women I ever knew. It might have been Charles Johnston's appearance that suggested to Bill a scam tailor-made for the Indian reservations. Before meeting Johnston, Bill had fallen back on his old deaf-and-dumb peddler routine. Native Americans believed that when the gods deprived people of one sense, they granted them supernatural healing powers in return, and this made them easy targets for Bill's act. Now he spotted a new opportunity. Charles Johnston had high cheekbones, nut-brown skin, and flowing black hair, and could easily be mistaken for a Native American. Bill hired him as his assistant, decked him out in splendid feathers and war paint, and featured him as his adopted Indian son. From the back of his wagon, Bill told his spellbound audience that Johnston, an Indian prince, had learned secret medicinal formulas from his father, a great chieftain. It was testimony to Bill's gall that Johnston had to pay him for this apprenticeship in fraud. "In spite of his friendship and liking for me," Johnston said, "he made me pay him $1,000 for my tuition, which illustrates his shrewdness as a bargain driver and his love of money." As he had once done with John, Big Bill toughened Johnston by goading and cheating him at every turn. One is left to wonder whether Bill saw in Johnston a substitute son who might fill the large emotional void left by his formerly adoring eldest son. As he traveled with Johnston across Illinois, Minnesota, Iowa, and the Dakotas, Bill's business methods deviated little from the methods he had honed in upstate New York. As Johnston recounted after Bill's death, "He would drive into a town, scatter handbills in which the great Dr. Livingston asserted that he could cure all diseases, and we would have a suite of rooms at the best hotel, and to the doctor there would come the sick and the halt and the lame. In all cases of common ailments, he could detect the cause almost at a glance." To impress yokels, Bill wore a glittering diamond in his shirt front, although when negotiating hotel rates, he covered it up to get the cheapest deal. According to Johnston, he pulled in hefty profits, sometimes $200 a day, and gave the false impression that he was worth several hundred thousand dollars. As in earlier years, Bill dabbled in commodity speculations. At one point, he bought 50,000 bushels of corn and stored them in bins, selling the lot for a steep markup when grasshoppers devoured crops the following summer. Johnston always admired this colorful, rough-hewn character with his bottomless bag of tricks. He was all business, and his mind was centered on the almighty dollar. At first, Johnston did not know that Dr. Livingston was related to the Rockefellers, though he noticed a recurring obsession with John D. Rockefeller, whom Livingston claimed to visit in Cleveland once or twice a year. He told me he went there to look after his money invested with John D. Rockefeller, and he would tell me wonderful stories of John, his shrewdness and great wealth. One time, a skeptical Johnston asked Bill how he knew this famous personage. "I started John D. Rockefeller in the oil business," Bill said flatly. "I loaned him the first money he invested in it, and I helped him all along." Bill boasted that his Standard Oil investment was now worth $375,000. He used to say that he made John D. rich, and he told me if I would stay with him and do as he said, he would make me rich too. At first, it never dawned on Johnston that Bill was Rockefeller's father, for the braggadocio seemed part of his Carnival Barker blarney. But when Bill began to chatter about old man Davison, Johnston recognized the name of Rockefeller's maternal grandfather and began to wonder. He remained suspicious for several years, while Bill resolutely denied the truth, scattering hints all the while. In 1881, John D. agreed to buy his father a 160-acre ranch in Park River, North Dakota, on a simple condition, that he never take Margaret Allen there. Bill spent winters with her in Freeport. Never resigned to his father's desertion and always fearing press exposure of his bigamy, John was still trying to lure his 71-year-old father back to Eliza and away from the sinful second marriage. Johnston later explained how Dr. Livingston had told him that John D. Rockefeller early had learned that his father was a bigamist and that the ranch in North Dakota had been taken by him upon the advice of John D., who, in the later years of his father's life, wished to wean him away from his second wife and have him live alone in a secluded place. Thus, if the old man should be discovered on his ranch, there would be no second wife with him. When Bill bought his first parcel of land in Park River, John allowed him to hold it under the name of Livingston. But when he purchased additional acreage in 1884, the deed was conveyed to Pearson Briggs, John's brother-in-law and a Standard Oil purchasing agent. In all likelihood, John paid for the property, using Briggs as a blind. When the land was conveyed back to Bill in 1886, he had to sign the transfer document William Avery Rockefeller, though he was known locally as Livingston, and one suspects that John insisted upon this step to strip Margaret Allen of any legal claim to the property. It was this legal maneuver that later established incontrovertibly that William Livingston and William Rockefeller were the same person. For a long time, Bill and Charles Johnston occupied adjoining properties in Park River and spent lazy summers hunting and fishing. Their secluded town, 30 miles from the nearest railroad, gave Bill exactly the protective distance from sheriffs and medical societies that he required. During the 16 summers he spent there, Bill shunned the main roads of town and carved out paths through the wheat fields. The townsfolk found him a queer, solitary old buzzard. Now and then, unaccountably, he cashed a Standard Oil check at the local bank. If the check was for $3,000, he might throw up his hands in mock surprise and pretend he had thought it was for only $300, as if someone of his wealth could afford to be negligent with money. Later on, when he became a physician of distinction and president of the College of Medicine and Surgery in Chicago, Charles Johnston feared legal repercussions for his earlier gypsy wanderings with Bill, and sought to portray him as a genuine folk healer instead of as a bald-faced quack. But neighbors had little doubt that Doc Livingston and Johnston were first-class bunco artists. They had a big jug full of medicine, and they treated all diseases from the same jug, one acquaintance recalled. I have often heard them joking together about the cure-all properties of the mixture in that jug. Dr. Livingston would say, "Yes, sir, that medicine will cure anything, providing the patient has got $5 to pay for a bottle of it." In this distant hamlet, Bill functioned as a medical factotum, rigging up a funny gadget that pulled an aching tooth for a buck, and he even did some horse doctoring. Johnston might never have unearthed the startling truth about Doc Livingston had it not been for a freak accident soon after they moved to Park River. They were constructing a cattle shed together when Bill injured himself lifting a heavy bar. Gasping in agony, he feared that he had a ruptured intestine and that death might be imminent. When Johnston asked if he should notify Margaret, Bill snapped, "I don't want the Allens to get any more of my money than I can help." Relations with the Allens were apparently no more cordial than with John Davison. Instead, Bill blurted out a shocking confession. He was the father of John D. Rockefeller, who should be informed in case he died. "No, you notify John D. Rockefeller, but be very careful and let no one else know it." When the injury wasn't fatal and Bill recovered, he tried to resume the tired old charade that he was unrelated to Rockefeller. But Johnston's hunch had now ripened into certainty, and Bill eventually gave up the game. Bill began to speak freely and often quite emotionally about his estranged son. When Johnston asked why he had concealed this relationship for so long, he told me that the reason he kept it secret was that he found it necessary in his younger days to assume a name because he was practicing medicine without a license. He might be arrested any time, and he did not wish to disgrace the name of Rockefeller because of his children. He stuck to the name later, he said, because it was then too late to honorably take the right name. This overlooks the awkward truth that he also assumed a new name to enter into a bigamous marriage with Margaret Allen and conceal the truth from Eliza. The stories about John D. suddenly came tumbling forth. Bill bragged about his career, always reserving a good deal of credit for himself. He never tired of boasting to me of John D.'s cleverness and how he was too smart for any of his competitors in the business. He seemed to just dote on John D. Rockefeller. He told me hundreds of anecdotes of John D.'s boyhood, of fishing and hunting with him, and of his cleverness and shrewdness as a boy. For all of Bill's glaring faults, there is something touching about a father admiring his extraordinary son from afar and taking vicarious pleasure in his achievements while being pointedly excluded from his affections. John's success provided its own tacit commentary on Bill's employment. Where Bill had squandered his considerable talents, John had succeeded on a scale that made Bill look cheap and tawdry. Like many pathological liars, Bill's achievements were too meager to satisfy his exaggerated need to feel important. He had never arrived at a larger vision of his own potentiality, remaining mired in the petty arts of a small-time con man. Charles Johnston finally wearied of his escapades with Bill and opted for a legitimate career. Like any Pied Piper, Bill was upset when one of his followers no longer hearkened to his beguiling tune. As Johnston remembered, "We parted when I decided to go to college and get a medical education and a diploma. He was very indignant at that. He declared that a college education would spoil me and that his was the only method of curing diseases." Bill later recanted and helped to put his young protégé through medical school. When Johnston began practicing medicine in Chicago, Bill visited and showered him with gifts, including his gold-headed cane and his violin. In the interest of protecting his newfound respectability, Johnston kept his frontier liaison with Bill a deeply buried secret until the press forced him to come clean in 1908. By this point, the search for Doc Rockefeller had developed into a national obsession. In March 1889, the ailing Eliza was at Williams' mansion at 689 Fifth Avenue when she suffered a stroke that paralyzed her right side. As she hung on for another 10 days, both John and William skipped work to maintain a bedside vigil. "She knew us all," John D. wrote of the deathbed scene to a cousin, "and did all her strength would permit to show her affection, appreciation, and Christian resignation." She died quietly on March 28th, age 76, never having known that her husband had taken a second wife, 20 years his junior, and adopted a brand new identity. John, William, and Frank buried their differences long enough to accompany the casket by train to Cleveland. Whatever solace John derived from Eliza's peaceful death was soon shattered by the events surrounding her funeral. Never accepting Bill's double life, John had sold his father's lot in Woodland Cemetery in 1882 so that he could be buried in the portion for him and mother in the Rockefeller family plot at Lakeview Cemetery. This transaction required Bill's signature, but John's relations with his father were so uneasy that he had to ask Brother Frank and Pearson Briggs to act as intermediaries. When Doc Rockefeller predictably bridled at this slap at his second marriage, John threw up his hands in frustration. "Guess you will have to manage this matter with him," he told Frank. John succeeded in making the transfer, for as Eliza's condition deteriorated in February 1889, he wrote to Frank and referred to the arrangement for father and mother to be buried in that portion which we have designated as theirs. Perhaps Bill pretended to submit to this arrangement only to placate John, for he had no real intention of being buried beside Eliza or abandoning Margaret. When Eliza's death seemed imminent, Frank alerted John that their father was suffering from asthma and would not attend the funeral service to be held at John's old Euclid Avenue house. Something snapped in John when his father thus offended his mother's memory, and he decided to kill him off, at least.